In the first message I shared with you in the last hour, I shared with you the story of Denny Uni, the neighborhood friend and bully of mine, and how, for no apparent reason, he'd be a friend one moment, and before I knew it, he was turning on me and beating me into the ground. There just seemed to be no apparent reason at that time. I couldn't figure it out. You can imagine, I was just fifth or sixth grade or something like that, and it just didn't make any sense to me. I was puzzled by it. I always thought about it. Matter of fact, I really didn't like being a friend of his, because I never knew when I was going to get beat up. But you know, there had to be some underlying reason for why he was doing it. You know, as I've grown older and have begun to understand things a little bit clearer, I think I've come to understand what was going on in that young man's life at that time. I'm convinced that Denny Uni came from an abusive home, and he was simply carrying out on me what was being carried out on his father, or by his father in his own home. The same goes today. There has to be, for this situation, where we've got a government that's, for some unknown reason or no known apparent reason, has ferociously decided to attack this thing called Christian identity. There's got to be a reason, whether we can figure it out or not. We know it's not because of the lies being perpetuated by the government itself and by the media, but there has to be a reason. And we do well to try to figure out what it is. So why? Why has the government so ferociously decided to attack Christian identity? And actually, unless you've got blinders on, anyone can see that there is a concerted effort by society as a whole against Christianity as a whole. It just so happens that Christian identity is their primary target. Why? Why would they do that? Again, we know it's not because of what so many people today are thinking because of the lies being told. But there has to be a reason. And as I began to point out in the last message, the reason for it begins with the conception and birth of a set of twins. I know it's hard to believe that what's going on today could take us back, all the way back, thousands of years ago, to that one little insignificant event. But I'll guarantee you, as we go on, you'll see that it does. Let's go back and read a portion of the story found in Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25, and I'd like to read verses 19 through 26 again. Verse 19, "Now these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padanaram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to Yahweh on behalf of his wife because she was barren. And Yahweh answered him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. But the children struggled together within her." A life and death struggle began. "And she said, if it is so, why then am I this way? So she went to inquire of Yahweh, and Yahweh said to her, 'Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples shall be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger.'" The reason for it again begins with this conception and the birth of these twins. Now I want you to note what was revealed to Rebekah by Yahweh was actually a future prophecy. It was more that than anything else. It was more a future prophecy than even explaining to her what was really going on in her womb. Not just about her two baby boys, but about their descendants. Listen to verse 23 in the King James Version this time. It says, "And Yahweh said unto her, 'Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger.'" In other words, though related, they would be very different. And they would spawn different ideologies, different cultures, different religions, different laws, and different governments. But not just different, but also conflicting and hostile to one another. In the last message, I demonstrated to you how the conflict which began in Rebecca's womb followed the two boys into manhood, and then even was passed, the feud was even passed on to her, their descendants. Now let me ask you this. Do you think that this feud that is so evident throughout the Old Testament would just all of a sudden disappear and end? I don't know about you, but I don't believe it would disappear unless the descendants themselves disappeared. After all, God did not put any time limitation on what he prophesied was to happen. And so there's no reason, if they're in existence, there's no reason to believe that this feud between these two peoples have ended. Now, doesn't it stand to reason that if these two peoples still exist, that they are still warring with each other, that they're still in a life and death struggle? Wouldn't it stand to reason that just as the infant Jacob somehow understood that he must fight with his brother Esau in Rebekah's womb, that their descendants, whoever they are today, are still doing the same, still jockeying for position? Edom swore to do just that. Listen to what it says in Malachi. You won't need to turn there. Malachi chapter 4 through 1 through 4. It says, "The oracle of the word of Yahweh to Israel through Malachi. I have loved you, says Yahweh, but you say, how hast thou loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, declares Yahweh. Yet I have loved Jacob, but I have hated Esau. And I have made his mountains a desolation and appointed his inheritance for the jackals of the wilderness." And listen to the first part of verse 4. It says, "Though Edom says, we have been beaten down, but we shall return and build upon the ruins." Edom knew she was getting whipped. But she said, "I'm returning and I'm going to build upon the ruins." Edom themselves prophesied that the war was to wage on, the battles would continue, that they wouldn't end. And doesn't it stand to reason that Esau, Edom would still hate Jacob, Israel today if they exist, and would want to destroy them? And wouldn't you suspect that in God's providence, as it's found in His Word, that in God's providence, these two peoples would be the two major players on the world scene today, if they exist? Well, without question, of course, the question, of course, is, do these two peoples exist? And if they exist, who are they? Now, if this struggle is continuing, and especially if it is being played out on a global scale, it becomes imperative, at least in my mind, it becomes imperative that we correctly identify both players. Now, for the average Christian today, I think they would admit that they have no idea, who the Edomites are. For the average person out there, ask them about the Edomites. The Whoites? They aren't going to know who the Edomites are. They probably wouldn't even recognize the term as coming from the Bible, for the most part. So I think they admit they don't know who the Edomites. But they certainly think they know who the other major player is, the Israelites, don't they? Of course they know. Of course, everyone knows who they are. They're the people today called Jews. They're the chosen people. They're today's descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Isn't that what you'd be told by the majority out there who claim to be Christian today? Now let me remind you, it stands to reason that between the Edomites and the Israelites, there would still be a jockeying for a position, just like there was in Rebekah's womb. Now consider this. If you were an Edomite, maybe one of you are out here, I don't know, they like to infiltrate our meetings a lot. Who knows what might be wrote up in the local paper. But if you were an Edomite, either consciously or intuitively, you knew that the Israelites had firstborn rights and would consequently be heirs of the kingdom and heirs of the blessings and you also believed that it had been wrongfully stolen from you, wouldn't it be advantageous on your part to convince the Israelites that they were not Israelites and you were? Doesn't that make sense? You say, "Preacher, you've got one fertile imagination." Well, you would have to admit that if Esau could get away with it, it would be a stroke of genius. And it's such a stroke of genius, many people would think, "I have a fertile imagination." Well, is it my imagination or is it their genius? I'll let you decide. Anyone, those of you here, and anyone who happens to hear this on tape, I'll let you decide. Just listen to a few of a myriad of Jewish quotes on this very thing. Listen first to the 1980 Jewish Almanac. If you were here 2 months ago when I preached, I used this quote then as well. Now, I asked Pete to make sure he brought his copy, and he didn't, so I brought the photocopy because I didn't want to pack it in my bag. So, but anyway, as you can see, I'm holding up a copy, photocopy of the cover of the 1980 Jewish Almanac. The first chapter is entitled Identity Crisis, with the subheading A Brief History of the Terms for Jew. Now, I'm not saying this. This is their admission. Listen closely to the very first sentence of this chapter called Identity Crisis, written by them. It says, "Strictly speaking, it is incorrect to call an ancient Israelite a Jew or to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite or a Hebrew." Now keep in mind, this wasn't written for your eyes. This wasn't written for Goyim eyes, as they would call you. This was written for their eyes. But when they write it for their eyes, sooner or later, it gets into our hands. It's right there. They've admitted, "We're not Israelites. We're not Hebrews." And as I pointed out to you not so long ago and gave you evidence after evidence that they admit to not being of Israelite descent at all, but of rather Khazar descent, of Turkish-Mongolian descent, rather than Israelite descent. Here's another one. This is by Nathan, by Leo Heineman. He reports that Nathan M. Pollock, who was professor of medieval Jewish history at Tel Aviv University, he reports that after spending 40 of his 64 years in research, that Nathan Pollock insisted, here's the article, photocopy of the very article, which was in the San Diego Union, August 28, 1966. Here's what he says that Nathan Pollock insists, quote, that 6 out of 10 Israelis and 9 out of 10 Jews in the Western Hemisphere are not real Jews, but descendants of fierce Khazar tribes which roamed the steppes of southern Russia many centuries ago. The materials available to prove historically that is exactly what happened. As a matter of fact, Arthur Kessler, another Jew, wrote a book that I brought with me last time. I think it's about 200 to 300 pages, where he completely documents in this book called The 13th Tribe that indeed the Jews today, the biggest majority, come from the Khazar tribes in the steppes of Russia. I believe it was in the somewhere between the 7th and 10th centuries A.D. On page 99, I didn't bring the book this time and read all the quotes again, but just from page 99 of chapter 8, which is entitled Race and Myth, here's what he says. He says, and kind of as a summation, he says, "In this last chapter, I have tried to show that the evidence from anthropology concurs with history in refuting the popular belief in a Jewish race descended from a biblical tribe, that is, an Israelite tribe." Now, I didn't say those things. And again, that's just a few quotes out of a myriad of quotes that I have photocopies of and that I've shared some of them with you in the past. That proves that it's not my fertile imagination, but that it's their stroke of genius. Here's what Paul Meyer said in Acteon in January 1913. He said, Yet I have a clever touch and pander to your vices while looking on in exultation. And so I play my game with the exuberance of experience, the strange and terribly subtle aims of my Asiatic blood that remain a mystery to you." And it certainly remains a mystery to the biggest majority of our people. But by God, they're going to learn. Because we're going to get the message to them, aren't we? Here's what Dr. Oscar Levi said in the preface to The World Significance of the Russian Revolution, written in 1920. He said, "And are not they," speaking of the Jews, he said, "are not they the inventors of the chosen people myth?" End quote. So there you have it. Not from my mouth, but testimony from their own mouths. But you know, this really shouldn't take anybody, any Christian, not just this group, but it shouldn't take any Christian who's read the Bible by surprise. Because it's exactly what God told us would happen. Turn to Revelation chapter 2 and verse 9. Revelation 2 and verse 9, it says, "I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan." Go to chapter 3 and verse 9. Very similar. It says, "Behold, I will cause those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews," that is Judites, consequently Israelites, "and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them to come down and bow down at your feet and to know that I have loved you." We shouldn't be surprised that the Jews are admitting that they're liars. It tells us right there that there would be imposters claiming to be Judahites or Israelites who lie. Shouldn't surprise us at all. Now, why would the Jews perpetuate such lies? I mean, why would a people like that just do that? Why would the Jews perpetuate such lies? Well, I'm here to tell you, it only makes sense if the Jews are Edom. Jockeying for position, claiming to be Israel in order to regain the birthright blessings. Now, anyone who doesn't think that there are blessings available in so doing, you just think about the land that's been robbed from the Arabs and given to the Jews. Or the millions and possibly billions that have been sent over there in foreign aid, sent to the Israelis in the land of Palestine, because preachers and politicians alike think they are today's Israelites. Don't tell me there aren't blessings to be secured by claiming to be the Israelites, the firstborns. They've proven it. Now, this hoax only makes sense, obviously only makes sense, if again the modern Jews are Esau. Now, could they possibly be, that's pretty bizarre. It's hard enough for people to see that they're not Israel. We've been brainwashed, we've heard it from the pulpits over and over and over again that the modern day Jews are Israel, in spite of the fact that they admit over and over again they're not, to themselves. And a few honest to us. That's hard enough to accept. But could they possibly not be Israelites and be Edom? And I know you're thinking to yourself, you know, your imagination's running away with you again, buddy. Well, by their own testimonies, they've admitted they're not Israelites. You think there's a possibility by their own testimony that they admit that they're Edom? Well, I'll prove again, it's not my imagination at all. I couldn't have come up with that. Listen to these quotes. Listen to these quotes from their own Jewish encyclopedias to begin with. Under the heading Edom, in the 1971 Encyclopedia Judaica, Volume 6 on page 378, you've got the documentation. You can check it out for yourself. Volume 6, page 338, it says, quote, "In the days of John Hyrcanus," which was at the end of the 2nd century BCE, and a little bit later it picks up, it says, "The Edomites became a section of the Jewish people," end quote. Under the heading Edom, Edumea, in the 1904 Jewish Encyclopedia, volume 5, page 41, it says, "They," the Edomites, they were then incorporated with the Jewish nation," end quote. Then under the heading Edom, Idumea, in the 1977 New Standard Jewish Encyclopedia, on page 589 it states, quote, from then on they, that again being the Edomites, from then on they constituted a part of the Jewish people, Herod being one of their descendants. And isn't it interesting that according to the 1983 National Geographic magazine, the Wailing Wall over in Jerusalem, which the Jews find so sacred, instead of being a part of Solomon's temple, is instead as, quote, Judaism's most sacred site, all that remains of Herod's magnificent temple, end quote. And everybody today thinks they're over there bowing down and kissing the Wailing Wall because it's Solomon's temple. It's Herod's temple. And Edomites, they know where their roots are. They know who they are, and it's time you and I understand who they are too, and many of you do, but it's time they understand out there as well. Also in the Antiquities of the Jews, book number 13, chapter 11 and verse 1, the famous first century Jewish historian by the name of Josephus, Flavius Josephus, he says, quote, they, the Edomites again, they were hereafter no other than Jews, end quote. The Edomites were hereafter no other than Jews. You know how ironic, the very people that most Christians today have identified as Israelites, the other major player, are instead the Edomites. Can you see what a tragic mistake that can be? You know, what a great ploy. You know, there's the enemies you've got to fear most are the enemies within the fort, the ones you don't know about. We're looking over there thinking that they're our allies. I wish I'd have brought a cartoon I've got. It's this guy says, you know, I've just about, he's sitting in his backyard on a, what do you call those things you lay out on? What's that? Some kind of chair. It wasn't a hammock. But anyway, he's laying there stretched out talking to his wife. Or I think he's talking to the guy over, leaning over the fence, and he says, you know, I've just about had it with supporting Israel over there. He says, you say one bad thing about them, and they blow their lid. And in the back of his house, he's got his back to his house, and behind his house comes in a jet fighter coming in with his bombs on him. You know, those are our allies. Great to be allies when you've got the, at least it's great to be enemies when you've got your enemies convinced that you're an ally. Now, why would Judeo-Christians have they made this major misidentification mistake? Well, here's why. And that's because a part of Edom's hoax has been the perpetuation of the Judeo-Christian hoax. Now, take note in what's becoming more and more the most accepted term for Christianity today. Take note in that term, who's getting first billing? It's called Judeo-Christianity. And could it be it's called that because it's just another sign of them jockeying for a position? What was it originally called? And it's not really been until fairly recent years that they even came up with the term Judeo-Christian heritage or Judeo-Christian ethic. What was it originally called? Just Christianity. Now it's become also Judeo-Christianity. And guess what the next stage is in this evolutionary process? Just Judaism. You think again, boy, you've got one good imagination, preacher. You don't believe it? Listen to these quotes. General Cornwallis, following his surrender at Yorktown, warned General George Washington with these words. Here's what he said. Matter of fact, this was quoted, I believe, by Senator McCarthy when he was still in office. He said this: your churches will be used to teach the Jews religion, and in less than 200 years, the whole nation will be working for divine world government. End of quote. That was stated by Cornwallis to General George Washington back in the 1700s. As far back as 1844, Karl Marx, who, by the way, was a Jew, Karl Marx had already declared the Jews' purpose and program in this very area. He said, quote, "The Jew has emancipated himself in a Jewish manner." Then later he said, "The practical Jewish spirit has become the practical spirit of the Christian nations. The Jews have emancipated themselves insofar as the Christians have become Jews." 1928, in an article entitled "A Real Case Against the Jews, One of Their Own Points to the Full Depth of Their Guilt," in Century Magazine, Marcus Eli Ravitch stated this. He said, "You make much noise and fury about the undue Jewish influence in your theaters and movie palaces. Very good. Granted, your complaint is well-founded. But what is that compared to our staggering influence in your churches, your schools, your laws, and your governments, and the very thoughts you think every day?" And probably the most astounding and revealing quote of all comes from, in this regard, comes from Rabbi Martin Siegel, printed in the January 18th, 1977, New York Magazine. Here's what he said. "I am devoting my lecture in this seminar to a discussion of the possibility that we are now entering a Jewish century, a time when the spirit of the community, the non-ideological blend of the emotional and rational, and the resistance to categories and forms will emerge through the forces of anti-nationalism to provide us with a new kind of society." And if you can make heads or tails of what he just said in that dialectical statement, you've got it on me. But listen to the last part. He says, "I call this process the Judaization of Christianity because Christianity will be the vehicle through which this society becomes Jewish." Now, do you want proof that it's working? Here's what Pat Boone had to say in a newspaper article dated 12/21/77. He was asked, quote, "More and more I hear you talking about Jewish things on television. My question is, have you converted to Judaism?" End quote. Here is a part of his response. Quote, "Occasionally we have special Hanukkah parties in our home and attend services at a nearly conservative temple. Why aren't we Christians? Yes, we are. And that's why we're feeling so Jewish. What so few people realize these days is that Christianity is a Jewish religion." And later he said, "We're members of the Christian branch of Judaism." And a little later, "Yes, I have become a Jew. My whole family have become Jews." People, their plan is working and has worked. The evolutionary process. As a matter of fact, you look at the evolutionary process of Pat Robertson. You know, once he was a Christian church, had been correctly come to Christ with the plan of salvation, he rejected that. He became faith only. He got then into the charismatic movement. And now look where it's led him. It's working. Their plan is in full force. And I'll guarantee their plan is just not for Judeo-Christianity. Their plan is for Judaism. And they're just about have got there with the majority of churches and pulpits today. Now here's something else which is interesting about these Edomite Jews. And that is that they are, for the most part, the manipulators of both national and world events today. Now, somebody, I'm sure, is bound to say, you know, you can't tell me everyone in the federal government, everyone in the FBI and FEMA and so forth and so on are Jews. Of course not. I wouldn't even attempt to try to convince you of that. But I will tell you, I'll let them tell you, that they are the ones behind the scenes calling the shots, pulling the strings on anything of world significance today that goes on. Let me read to you from the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which, by the way, from what I understand, if you've found caught with one of these in New York City, they can commit you to an insane asylum. Now, and I'm talking about I'm not talking about the same kind of asylum we were talking about before. Now, for those who may not know what the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion actually are, the protocols are actually the minutes from the first Zionist Congress held in Basel, Switzerland in 1897. Basically, it's Zionism's plan of world conquest. And as I've stated this before, to me there is nothing that amazes me more than God's holy word, and certainly it should. In Hebrews 4:12, it says that the word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing as far as the division of soul and spirit, of both joints and marrow, and able to judge the thoughts and the intentions of the heart. And if you've spent any time in it yourself, you know how magnificent and how wonderful and how astounding it really is. But I want to tell you the most astounding book that I've seen next to it. It's this one right here. I will be carrying this shortly, but in the meantime, if you don't have a copy, I encourage you to order one from Pete. It's amazing how in 1897 they planned it out and how they have carried this out and continue to carry out their plans upon the American and national and world societies exactly as they said they would. Here's what they have to say in regards to them being behind the scenes calling the shots, beginning with Protocol 1. In Article 15, they state, "Our power in the present tottering condition of all forms of power will be more invincible than any other, because it will remain invisible until the moment when it has gained such strength that no cunning can no longer undermine it." Let's go to Protocol number 2, Article 5 and Sentences 4 and 5. Here it says, "But the Goyim states have not known how to make use of this force, and it has fallen into our hands. Through the press, we have gained the power to influence while remaining ourselves in the shade." Let's go to Protocol number 9, in Article 3, Sentence 3 through Article 4. Listen carefully, especially this first sentence. Here's what they say end of Article 3. It says, "And the weapons in our hands are limitless ambitions, burning greediness, merciless vengeance, hatreds, and malice." Man, are they exposing their hand. Continues on, "It is from us that the all-engulfing terror proceeds. We have in our services persons of all opinions, of all doctrines, restorating monarchs, demagogues, socialists, communists, and utopian dreamers of every kind. We have harnessed them all to the task. Each one of them, on his own account, is boring away at the last remnants of authority, is striving to overthrow all established form of order. By these acts, all states are in torture. They exhort to tranquility, are ready to sacrifice everything for peace, but we will not give them peace until they openly acknowledge our international supergovernment and with submissiveness." Going on now to Article 13. Protocol 13 in Article 6, it says, "Who will ever suspect then all these people were stage managed by us according to a political plan which no one has so much as guessed at in the course of many centuries?" You don't have to believe me that they're behind the scenes. They've admitted it as far back as in 1897, and they have performed it beautifully ever since. So now, we have one of the two major players identified, the Edomites of modern Jewry. Now that leaves the Israelites. Now if the people called to Jews today aren't Israelites, who are? Now, just think about this. I know most of you are far ahead of this at this point, but just think about this. If the Jews aren't Israelites, and they've admitted over and over again that they're not, then somebody today has to be. Whether you're a preacher out there believing that God no longer has a plan for physical Israel or not, still somebody has to be Israel today. God promised that He'd work with them forever throughout eternity. Promise after promise of that. And you just can't wipe out approximately 30 million people who went into the Babylonian and Assyrian captivities. They just don't vanish off the face of the earth. Someone today has got to be Israel. Well, one way to identify them, and the last time I was here, we went into all kinds of different things, from the Bible and archaeology and history to prove who they are today. But here's one way that I've never thought about identifying them before necessarily. One way of locating these people is by finding the people whom the Edomites hate most. Wouldn't that be an identifying mark of those people? Well, listen to what they say. In 18, 1869, I think it is. I can't read my writing. But near 1869 or 59, Rabbi Reichhorn, while delivering the funeral oration of Grand Rabbi Simeon ben Yehuda, stated, "Every 100 years, we, the sages of Israel, have been accustomed to meet the Sanhedrin in order to examine our progress towards the domination of the world which Jehovah has promised us and our conquest over the enemy, Christianity." Well, he said every 100 years they have a tendency to do that, or approximately. Well, in 1897 they did just that. They met in Basel, Switzerland. Let me read to you from Protocol 17, in Article 2, sentences 1 through 3. Here's what it says. It says, "We have long past taken care to discredit the priesthood of the Goyim, and thereby to ruin their mission on earth, which in these days might still be a great hindrance to us. Day by day, its influence on the peoples of the world is falling lower. Freedom of conscience has been declared everywhere, so that now only years divide us from the moment of the complete wrecking of the Christian religion." Also, in 1903, Bernard Lazare put it this way in his book, Anti-Semitism, Its History and Causes. He said, "In brief, there is no wickedness in the world which the Jews are not guilty of, so that they seem to aim at nothing but the Christians' ruin." Now, somebody's going to, who knows, it may hit the papers, the headlines, somebody's going to call Pastor Ted Weiland an anti-Semite for stating what that just stated. But I'm just quoting one of theirs. Going on, he also said, "The Jews did not stop there." And then he picks it up and says, "Their activity was such as to give rise to a general belief in the existence of a secret society sworn to the destruction of Christianity." Another place, he says, "attacking all dogmas and forms of Christianity with a bitterness entirely Judaic." Where does bitterness come from? Anger? Perpetual hatred? Possibly? "Again, attacking all dogmas and forms of Christianity with a bitterness entirely Judaic, and with all the subtlety of those peerless causesists who created the Talmud." And then lastly, he says, "The Jew," a little bit later, he says, "is not content merely to destroy Christianity, but he preaches the gospel of Judaism. He not only assails the Catholic or the Protestant faith, but he incites to unbelief and then imposes on those whose faith he has undermined with his own conception of the world, of morality, and of life." Two different lifestyles, two different theologies, two different perceptions of the world. And then it says, "He is engaged in his historic mission, the annihilation of the religion of Christ." Now keep in mind, it was prophesied that the Israelites to whom the new covenant, that it was prophesied that it was the Israelites to whom the new covenant would be made with. What's the new covenant religion called? Christianity. It was to the Israelites that it had been prophesied that it would belong to them. In Hebrews 8:8, quoting Jeremiah 31:31, it says, "And I will effect a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." And anybody out there who may think that's spiritual, you just read the next two verses. Because very clearly the next two verses show us that those peoples have to be physical people that the new covenant was made with, because they're literal descendants of the people Moses brought out of Egypt. The new covenant was made with those physical group of people. So much for God having no plan for Israel under the new covenant, hey? He certainly does. He made the new covenant with them, or at least a remnant of those who would accept it. Consequently, the blessings which belonged to Israel as the firstborn passed on under the new covenant to the remnant of Israelites who became Christians. So you would expect the Edomites' biggest beef to be with Christian Israel, because they're now the ones who have the firstborn rights. And what people today, just being honest, and again I say this more so to maybe possibly the tape audience who may hear this rather than you here, but just being honest, that's all I ask. Which people over the last 2,000 years have been the people who have primarily, if not almost exclusively, accepted the new covenant religion of Christianity? who have been responsible for printing over 98% of all the Bibles and getting them out to the world. I know it was the Negroes. Oh, it wasn't them? It was the Arabs? No, it wasn't those they either. Oh, it was the Egyptians. Maybe it was the Israelites. What people was it? How about the Celto, Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, and kindred peoples? And nobody can deny that, because it's history and it's fact. God said, I'm making that my religion with them. Wouldn't it be those people, Christian, Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, and kindred peoples, that Edom would have its biggest beef with? Now here's some other quotes that will further establish that indeed it was with these people, or it's these people whom they hate most. 1939, Harry Wotton, in a book, his book, entitled A Program for the Jews and an Answer to All Anti-Semites, on page 36, wrote this: the communists are Marxist, Bolsheviks, internationalist, Jews, enemies of the Aryans and their cultures. Really, it would have been better to say the Jews are communist, Marxist, Bolsheviks, internationalist, enemies of the Aryans, but one way or the other, it still says the same thing. It says, he said, a Jew said, Harry Wotton said that they were enemies of the Aryans. In 1968, Eli Weissel, is that how you pronounce his name? Anybody know? Eli Weissel. Okay, Eli Weissel in Legends of Our Time state or wrote, every Jew somewhere in his being should set apart a zone of hate, healthy, virile hate for what the German personifies and for what persists in the German. Why do you think they picked out the Germans? Of course, it was because of the Holocaust, right? Well, could it be? Could it be because the Germans, it's certainly becoming more and more apparent that the Germans are Judah. And that's who they want to get most. Also in 1968, James Yaffe, in his book, I didn't write it down here, The American Jews, wrote this. He said, it's almost as if some symbiotic relationship now exists between the Jews and the Germans representing the Aryans or the Celto-Saxons. It is almost as if some symbiotic relationship now exists between the Jews and the Germans. We can never break loose from them. We're doomed to go through the ages together, tied to them by our hatred. Now, who do the Edomites hate most? The Celto-Saxon peoples, and most specifically, the Christians. Now, there are many other proofs. Biblical, as I pointed out, archaeological, recent archaeological finds, historical evidence of who Israel is. And it all backs up this identifying mark as well. That Israel, indeed, are those people known today. The nation, the multitude of people who were to become a multitude of nations, known as the Celto-Saxon, Germans, Scandinavian, so forth peoples. There is undeniable evidence, most specifically from the Bible. They're the only people, for example. You take all the identifying marks of Israel of old that you'd expect to find in Israel of modern times, and they are the only people on the face of the earth today who can fulfill all of those marks of Israel. But suffice it to say, with just that one evidence, based on who Edom hates most, we've now identified both major players in the world on the world scene today. Edom is found in modern Jewry by their own testimony, and Israel is found in the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, and kindred peoples. And as a result, we now know the real reason why they're so riled. They're trying to get back the birthright blessings, which they lost all the way back at the time that Jacob and Esau were growing up as boys. We now know the real reason why Christianity is under attack today and why Christian identity is the primary target. It's just a manifestation of that age-old battle between Esau, Edom, and Jacob, Israel. What a story. What a story. Now, just as many Christians today are in the dark concerning all of this, I'm convinced that many of the Jews today are just as much in the dark and haven't put this together either. You know, I rode, Pete and I, going to, I believe it was the camp in West Virginia last fall. If you've heard his tapes, you've probably heard about the Jewish lady who wanted to sit down and have him hold his hand. Well, we just acted like dumb goyim and started questioning her on different things to see if we could find out any information from her, and it was amazing. We asked her about the Talmud. This was a professing Jew, and I think it was both of our estimation that she was telling us the truth. She'd never heard of it before in her life. She didn't know whether she was an Ashkenazic or a Sephardic Jew. She'd heard the terms, but wasn't sure which she was. And so forth and so on. It's amazing sometimes, again, just how much they've been duped, the average one out there, as much as the goyims have. I'm convinced that many Jews don't have this all put together. But at the same time, here's one who didn't have it all put together, but listen to what Maurice Samuel wrote in his book, You Gentiles, in 1924, in spite of the fact he didn't understand it all. On page 19, he said he made these statements. He said, "I have said there are two life forces in the world I know, Jewish and Gentile," or he was referring to white Christianity. Again, he says, "There are two life forces in the world I know, Jewish and Gentile, ours and yours. If this be a truth, we must not be driven from it." And then he also said on page 19, he said, "What their origin was, I cannot say. I can only surmise dimly." And then he also said, "I can only affirm to the Jews in the main belongs the Jewish life force, a consistent and coherent force, a direction in human thought and reaction. To you others belongs the Gentile life force, a mode of life and thought distinct from ours." And again, can't you see the fulfillment right before our eyes, written by this Jew, of what was prophesied to Rebekah about these two boys that were warring in her womb, about two nations being totally different and even hostile to each other? He's admitting the same thing. On page 21, he says this, "The cleavage is there, abysmal and undeniable. In the main, we are forever distinct. Ours is one life, yours is another." Then on page 23 through 24, he says, "I do not believe that this primal difference between Gentile and Jew is reconcilable. You and we may come to an understanding, never to a reconciliation. There will be irritation between us as long as we are in intimate contact. For nature and constitution and vision divide us from all of you forever. Not a mere conviction, not a mere language, not a mere difference of national or religious allegiance," and he's admitting all of that. But he says, "With the best will on both sides, successful adaptation to each other will always be insecure and transient." And then on page 24 he also said, "But as has come to pass so often, the difference which is deeper than will, deeper than consciousness, will assert itself." You talk about a perpetual hatred. You talk about a perpetual war that would always go on between the two sons and their progeny. He's just written it out. Esau, Edom, and Jacob, Israel, have been jockeying for position since Rebekah's womb. Lately, it's been Edom who's had the upper hand. Without doubt. It's been by a stroke of genius, all that they've done. The more you read from them, the more you read about them, it amazes me how brilliant they have been and people how stupid the goyim have been. They've been brilliant and they've got the upper hand. But God has promised they've got the upper hand. They've jockeyed themselves into position. They've jockeyed themselves into position, so to speak, into the birth canal once again. But it's Israel that's been promised the delivery. Turn with me, if you would, to Micah chapter 4. And I hope you're encouraged by the last part of that. You know, I don't want you to go away from here thinking, man, yeah, they are brilliant. Yeah, they've been successful. Yeah, they are on top. And look what they're doing to us. And how in the world can it ever change? But I want to tell you, it's going to change. They may be in the birth canal, but this time, Jacob Israel has them by the heels, and he's going to yank them out of there. Because it's not them who were promised the delivery. It was Israel. Or it is Israel. Micah 4, in verses 8 through 10, it says, "And as for you, tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you it will come, even the former dominion will come, the kingdom of the daughter of Jerusalem. Now why do you cry out loudly? Is there no king among you? Or has your counselor perished, that agony has gripped you like a woman in childbirth? Writhe in labor to give birth, daughter of Zion, like a woman in childbirth. From now on you will go out of the city, dwell in the field, and go to Babylon. There you will be rescued. There Yahweh will redeem you from the hand of your enemies." Did you hear what it said? It said that even the former dominion, the kingdom of the daughter of Jerusalem, will be given back to you. They've got to hold the heels, and they aren't letting go either. But this time, Esau is not going to be the firstborn. No, instead, Esau's not promised delivery. He's promised abortion or infanticide. Turn with me to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Verses 1 through 3. Listen carefully. It says, "Now as to the times and the epochs, brethren, you have no need of anything to be written to you, for you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night. While they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly, like birth pangs upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape." Who shall not escape? Turn to Malachi chapter 1. I read Malachi chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, or at least part of 4 to you before, but this time I want to read it all. Malachi chapter 1, and just verses 4 and 5 this time. Verse 4 says, "Though Edom says, 'We have been beaten down, we will return and build up the ruins,' thus says Yahweh of hosts, 'They may build, but I will tear down, and men will call them the wicked territory, and the people toward whom Yahweh is indignant forever. And your eyes will see this, and you will say, Yahweh be magnified beyond the border of Israel.'" Now I hope you take hope in that. Yes, indeed, there is still a war that's waging in the birth canal. But this time, it'll be Israel who's born, not Edom. And you know what even excites me more than that? Is how it's going to take place. Turn to Obadiah. And I want to read, I'm going to skip around a little bit, but begin with verses 1 through 4. Aren't you there yet? Obadiah, it's in there somewhere. It's only one chapter, so she's hard to find. If you're not there, you just listen. Verses 1 through 4, it says, "The vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord Yahweh concerning Edom, 'We have heard a report from Yahweh, and an envoy has been sent out among the nations, saying, Arise and let us go against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. The arrogance of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock and the loftiness of your dwelling place, who say in your heart, Who will bring me down to earth? Though you build high like an eagle," isn't that what they claimed in Malachi, "we're going to rebuild upon the ruins?" He said, "Though you build high like an eagle, though you set your nest among the stars," and isn't that where they're at right now? Ruling and reigning. But not with Yahshua the Christ. And thus they're doomed to fall. He says, "Though you build high like an eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares Yahweh." Jump to verse 15, and it says, "For the day of Yahweh draws near on all the nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head." Amen. Amen. Verses 17 and 18, it says, "But on Mount Zion there will be the..." Listen carefully. Here's the part I take most encouragement in. It says in verse 17, "But on Mount Zion there will be those who escape, and it will be holy. And the house of Jacob will possess their possessions. Then the house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame. But the house of Esau will be as stubble, and they will set them on fire and consume them, so that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau, for Yahweh has spoken." It sounds as if Jacob, Israel, is going to do it all, but let me guarantee you, it's only by the hand of Yahweh, the arm of the Lord, not the arm of the flesh. Let's not forget that. And then let's read verse 21. It says, "The deliverers will ascend Mount Zion to judge the mountains of Esau." And then listen to the last part. "And the kingdom will be Yahweh's." Isn't it already Yahweh's? It certainly is. But we've given up dominion. Jacob, Israel, it should be theirs. They should have been taking dominion all along. And so it's going to take this to get it completely back, and back in His power, and back in the order He intends it to be. What a victory picture. And what a picture, what a story that begins all the way back in the womb of two boys. Two boys who fought in the womb, that passed on their feud to their descendants, who are indeed still living today and still warring with each other today as well. Now, in light of what we just read about the victory, about the deliverance, about the fact that Jacob, Israel, is the victor, can you see why God doesn't want us to fear their conspiracies? He's promised. We win. Shame on us when we fear. Now let me share with you just one aspect of God's power, and in so doing show you how ridiculous it is to consider the thought that they might overthrow Him from His throne. In 2 Kings chapter 6, in verses 16 through 17, when Syria warred against Israel, Elisha comforted his trembling servant with these words. In verse 16 and 17 he said, "So he answered, 'Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them.' Then Elisha prayed and said, 'O Yahweh, I pray, open his eyes that he may see.' And Yahweh opened the eyes of... And Yahweh opened the servant's eyes, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around." Let me tell you something. If Elisha's servant couldn't see them, I'll guarantee they can't see them either. They may surround a place like Waco, Texas. They may surround a place like Ruby Creek, Idaho. They may surround a place like that... like LaPorte Church of Christ, but they're the ones who are surrounded because they can't see the armies of fire that are surrounding them, that they're blind to. But not only that, we then also have the account in 2 Kings chapter 19 when Sennacherib, king of Assyria, was attacking Jerusalem, and in the story we're told that one angel destroyed 185,000 soldiers in one night. One angel. Can you contemplate that? Can you contemplate that? One angel wiping out 185,000 soldiers. Well, if you can't contemplate that, you try to contemplate this. In Matthew 26 and verse 53... we're told there that Yeshua had at His disposal 12 legions of angels. Anybody know how many soldiers are in a legion? 6,000. And He had 12 legions of them. Now, how's your arithmetic? How many angels did He have? 72,000 angels at His disposal. How good is your arithmetic? One angel killed 185,000 soldiers. How's your arithmetic today? 185,000 times 72,000. You want the figure? 13 billion. 320 million soldiers worth of killing power in one night. And you see how ridiculous it is for us to fear their conspiracies? God, we are fools if we do. And not only that, we're idolaters. I'm not one who likes bumper stickers. But there's one bumper sticker that I will never forget and that I'll love to the day I die. I think I saw it when I used to live in Denver, Colorado. It was a bumper sticker that had Romans 8:31 written across it. I'll turn there quickly and read it to you. Romans 8 and verse 31, it says, "What shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us?" Had that written across the top of the bumper sticker, and then underneath it, it had that verse diagrammed. And what was going on was a tug of war, with the angels on one side and the demons on the other. And on the demons' side, I tell you, their faces were all screwed up, and they were sitting there, they had their heels dug in, and I mean, they were giving it everything they had. And the other side of the tug of war, on the other side of the rope, were the angels. And there was some going like this, and, you know, just putting a finger on the rope. But what made the picture describe what's found here in Romans 8:31 is the big thumb that was holding down the rope on the angel's side. If God is for us, people, who can be against us? I want to end this message with another poem by Glenn Pollard that certainly fits in with all that I've shared with you, and especially with the ending that I've given you. The picture of hope that I hope that I've instilled within your hearts and your souls. And indeed, we have nothing to fear, because we are indeed the victors if we endure to the end. Listen to it. It's called Edom Stubble. The winds are a-changing, they're blowing full bore, and fanning the spark is the Babylonian whore. She is fanning the remnant to engulf them at last, till Babylon the Great is a beast of the past. Now I'm carrying scars, but I'm still doing fine. I may not have won, but at least I am trying. I am one of the remnant, the first into war, chosen from heaven to destroy Babylon's great whore. We know Esau is stubble and Jacob a fire, and that Esau's descendants are nothing but liars. Now Jacob is a-smoking and is fixing to glow on the stubble of Edom from the fire down below. Oh, cry ye, Edom, with your crocodile tears. You've been thorns in the side of Jacob for years. Now you've fanned the flame that you've spread all about till you're finally surrounded. It cannot be put out. But with all your teardrops and water and seas, your thirst is not quenched with the fire round your knees. And with all of this water, you're burned into rubble. For as Obadiah said, Esau is but stubble. Can you say hallelujah to that?
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed being here. I love you all, and I'll keep you in prayers if you'll keep me in yours. Thank you.